Hi, friends, and welcome to the Plus Mommy Podcast. I'm your host, Jen McClellan, and here we explore plus-size pregnancy, motherhood, and body love. From bumps to bellies, we talk about it all. Now, let's get started. Hi, friends. As you know, I am always honored when people come onto the show to share their stories. And today we are joined by Jeannie and we are honoring her daughter, Marion, who she had at 22 weeks because of an incompetent, or they also call it a cervical insufficiency. And Jeannie really wants to share her whole journey and also to raise awareness about this condition that can happen in 1 in 100 pregnancies. So Jeannie, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jen.
It means so much. Well, why don't we start at the very beginning of your story when you were, you know, trying to become pregnant?
So I, like a lot of career kind of driven people, I prevented pregnancy for a very long time. I've been with my husband and my partner since I was 18 years old, and I prevented pregnancy until I was 29 years old with using birth control. And then, you know, my mom had always said that one day you'll feel that, you know, you're ready, because I'd always wanted children. I just knew I wasn't ready. And my husband's about 9 years older than me. So we kind of waited, but then all of a sudden I just knew, and I wanted to, I was pretty sure the moment I came off birth control that I would just get pregnant.
That's
the way it works, right? That's what they teach us in school. And I'm a registered nurse by training and pretty, you know, well-educated on the reproductive system, or I thought I was. that was a big misconception. And, so we tried, for a year naturally. I got really, kind of did my research to get involved, started to using like luteinizing hormone strips, sort of like the ovulation predictor strips.
Yeah.
Started, you know, doing cervical mucus, really trying to get educated on different types of fertility tracking methods, because my cycles were extremely regular. Other than being a plus size woman, I identify as someone who's really, you know, feels very healthy, and I was confident, and physically I felt really well. So they're really, and I mean, my husband and I definitely did not have a lack of intimacy. It just didn't happen. And about a year and 2 months afterwards, I went to seek out a fertility clinic. And being, you know, someone with a BMI of over 40, I was really nervous about, would I find someone who would treat me?
Yeah, you're not alone in those nerves. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, a simple Google on fertility, it basically says, like, if you're overweight, forget it. But here locally, so I'm just outside of Niagara Falls, Canada, we have good access to fertility treatments. They're not cheap, but I did find a clinic that said, you know what, we welcome people of any size, color, shape, race, orientation, whatever. We welcome you.
Wonderful.
We'll give you a workup. It was amazing. And the physician I met, I told him, you know, on my intake, which was during COVID lockdown, so it was all virtual. He said, okay, and your weight and your height. And I gave it to him, which normally I would totally lie through my teeth, but I gave him the information, and he just said, yeah, he's like, you know, fertility sometimes can be related to weight if there's issues that are impacted by your weight. But based on everything we know about you, that may or may not be the case. So if you want to lose weight, go for it. And if you don't, that's okay too. Just focus on healthy eating, things that nourish your body. And I felt so relieved, because I anticipated the doctor to say, like, yeah, lose weight and then we'll treat you. But no, this, my physician was very welcoming. So we did like an investigation cycle and found that I ovulated pretty much like the textbook on day 14 of my cycle.
Wow.
It was super fascinating to learn about, you know, how my estrogen rose and my luteinizing hormone rose. And I had blood tests and these vaginal ultrasounds regularly. And I could see the follicle growing. And then I could see that it ruptured and it was gone. And then, you know, you just wait and think, oh my gosh, am I going to get pregnant? Because I had sex on the days I was quote unquote supposed to. And then you go for your beta ultra, like, you know, your beta blood test to check for your pregnancy, and it's negative. You go, okay, well, didn't work this month. So the physician reviewed all of my labs, all of my workup. My husband did a semen analysis, and he called us, you know, just at the end of our cycle and said, okay, there's nothing wrong that we can find. He said maybe a tiny bit of impaired motility on your husband's sperm, possibly, but not enough to significantly impact, you know, chances of conception. And he gave me the options. He said, you know, we can try to use medications to get you to supraovulate, so ovulate more than one egg. We can do intrauterine insemination or IUIs, or we can jump straight to IVF, which is, you know, about $10,000 and not covered. And you may or may not have coverage for the medication to use. So hubby and I were pretty eager to just jump into, we'd done kind of timed intercourse as far as I was concerned, because I'd been doing the tracking and the cervical mucus and all that kind of stuff. And we went straight into an IUI with superovulation. So they gave me Clomid, and I followed through on the next cycle, and I had two eggs that I ovulated, went through the whole process. My husband did, you know, he gave his sample. They did a wash on it, a sperm wash, and we did an IUI. And it didn't hurt. It was super easy. I was like, I don't know what I thought it was going to be, but it was very straightforward.
Yeah.
Then those 2 weeks of just really, really difficult waiting. And then we found out it didn't work. I wasn't pregnant. So we did it again the next month, back to back.
Yeah.
Another round of Clomid. I had three eggs this time. Same process, didn't work again. We did that 5 times in a row, 5 months back to back.
I can only imagine how that impact, I mean, for over a year now, you two have been trying, and now to go through this in 5 times, oh, my heart. I know that we've had other stories of people starting with IUI, and, you know, we have such hope, but it doesn't always work. And I wish that wasn't the case.
Yeah. I mean, the physician gave us the chances of conceiving with IUI was between 10 and 15%, maybe a slightly lower than that. Someone who was, you know, mid 20s, but still a pretty decent conception rate for someone who's been trying so many times. And being the ever optimist that I was, I figured it would work. I really did. Yeah. And it didn't, the negatives never got any easier. My husband will tell you that he anticipated a negative. I always anticipated a positive and then was gutted when it was a negative.
Oh, Jeannie.
But, you know, pretty quickly after that, I decided that IVF was the way forward. I did not want to wait. Those were my words to the physician. And the next cycle started a round of IVF. My physician used a pretty conservative, like, IVF protocol for me, and I responded really, really well. So one of these things that, you know, when your BMI is over 40, they'll treat you, but they will not give you sedation for your egg retrieval.
Yeah, because there's slightly increased risk with that anesthesia. And it's very, it's very frustrating. But the risks are still so minimal.
So, and it felt almost cruel when I asked questions because, you know, they just basically said, this is our policy. And if we had an anesthesiologist, it would be different. And I said, well, can I go to somewhere that does have one? The answer was no. And it was basically your choice is to endure the possible pain, which sounded pretty awful when I learned about it, or not. So those are my options, do it or don't. And for me, it was never an option not to. So I went forward with the egg retrieval. And you know what? I did it with, I had some Tylenol 3 and like the lorazepam to kind of help me relax. And you know, it wasn't fun. It wasn't pleasurable by any means, but it was, for me personally, I was very fortunate. My physician's very gentle. And I had 12 eggs retrieved. It did not, I was not in a ton of pain. It was not a terrible procedure. I would actually, if I had the choice, I think the sedation might have actually been more challenging for me than anything.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that it wasn't as horrific as it can sound, but I do know that we've had someone else share the same experience on the show of not having access to anesthesia for egg retrieval, and it wasn't as pleasant of an experience as you went through. So I'm really glad that for you it wasn't bad, but for others it really has been, and it just is infuriating to me to think that someone must go through egg retrieval without any form of anesthesia. It's baffling to me. I mean, you just think even like a placement of a IUD without a little bit of local anesthesia, like the things that people with uteruses go through. I mean, it's just, I'm really sorry that you had to go through that. You're a very brave and determined human, and I admire that about you, but I just want to hold space that just seems very barbaric to me. And I'm really sorry when there is such low risk that they just rule it out for people with a higher BMI.
I you know, I feel very fortunate that my mental capacity at that time, I think, helped me get through the pain, and the fact that my physician was very skilled. And I was lucky. I'm not sure if the next time would be as good or you know, as quote unquote easy, I guess. I'm not saying it was easy, but it was not what I cooked it up to be. Maybe I just thought it would be a lot worse than that. But we were lucky. We had 12 eggs retrieved and 11 were mature and 10 fertilized. So we were really thrilled with that. Yes. And then you have that dreadful 5-day wait to see how many make it to a day 5 blastocyst. Which is, you know, nice quality embryo. And we decided to do genetic testing on our embryos just because for me and my personality type, if I had a failed embryo transfer, I would always wonder, was it genetically abnormal or was it my body that, you know, implantation didn't work or whatever. So we had 3 embryos that made it to day 5. Mm-hmm. And we sent them off for genetic testing, and 2 were genetically normal, and 1 is a low-level mosaic that they still recommended that we could use. We were really happy with everything. You know, it sounds like, well, we started with 10 eggs, then we ended up with 3. I was kind of really devastated, but after doing a bit of, you know, self-advocacy to the doctors and the nurses, they shared with me kind of what I should expect from IVF, which is something that I would recommend to anyone going through IVF, is setting your expectations or understanding your expectations from the scientific standpoint before you go into it is really, really, really important. Because I thought 10 eggs, 10 babies. That is not even close to the case.
No.
But again, I felt really good post-transfer or post-retrieval, And I was physically active again within a day or two. And I didn't really have any of the classical symptoms that I thought I might have.
I'm so glad. I'm so happy for you. And I think it's also hopeful for people that might be in your shoes hearing that you had a positive experience with that. So thank you too.
It was super positive. And, you know, I was more than prepared for the worst situation possible, but did pretty good overall. And I took a month break just to let my body heal and recuperate. And reality is, I didn't actually have an option. They sent my embryos off for the genetic testing and they made me wait a month. But in hindsight, it was the best thing to do because I think it really gave me just a month to relax and not, you know, be so focused on all these medications and all these stimulation protocols. And we still tried naturally that month. Don't get me wrong. I still did everything that I thought I could because this ever, you know, unexplained infertility doesn't mean I can't get pregnant. It just means I probably won't, but that's not a 0% chance. So in my mind, it's still possible.
Yes.
Yeah. So the following month we transferred, and my physician's an older gentleman. He's conservative with the way that he approaches, especially for someone like me who had a very normal hormonal profile. He did recommended a natural cycle. So we did that. They monitored my ovulation. I ovulated normally. I started progesterone and a couple other, you know, medications that he likes to add, like baby aspirin and a prednisone just to help with implantation. And on day 5, December 7th, I did an embryo transfer. And 10 excruciating days after that, I went for my beta pregnancy test. And I did not test on a home pregnancy test. I was so, so proud of myself that I waited.
Wow.
A little superstition inside of me just wanted to wait for the final. I just thought it would, you know, I had enough kind of ups and downs. So I just wait for the blood test. Yeah. And I'll never forget that phone call because the nurse was just in tears. I mean, I've been with this team for like 8 months, 9 months. Mm-hmm. And they'd seen me through my ups and downs, and then they gave me the good news. It was positive. So my husband and I were just overjoyed.
Yes.
I'd never been pregnant in my life, and I didn't feel any different. I don't know why I thought I would magically just feel different. But I didn't have any symptoms. Like, again, if I Googled, I should have breast pain and I should have this and I should have that. And,
but it's, we're days in with the IVF that they can tell whether it worked or not. So, you know, I understand. You're like, wait, I should be feeling all this different. But like, you literally just implanted, like, our bodies are so, so amazing. Oh gosh.
It was just phenomenal to watch the HCG rise. Like at that point, I think that's the only point in my life that I was like eager to go and get a needle put in my arm to get a blood test, because I'm like, I want to know so badly what my HCG is. But
just for everyone listening, I think we assume everyone knows, but like when you take a pregnancy test and when you urinate on that stick, it is looking for your HCG levels. And when you are pregnant, those levels duplicate and go up rapidly. And we're always looking for an increase in those levels to show that it is a viable pregnancy. So when you're under the care of a fertility specialist, having those blood draws can get real specific and make sure those numbers are continuously rising.
It's exciting and anxiety provoking, but when the nurse calls in your number and your number's double or triple, or I think one time I had tripled, I was just like, oh my gosh, it's working.
Yes.
You know, just anxiously excited. And we told my mom and dad immediately and my in-laws immediately and no one else. It was like, you know, let's just go through Christmas. And we celebrate Christmas. We're not huge, you know, people in the holiday time. And it was, again, during COVID lockdown, so to speak. But we bought our first Christmas ornament that was like a little a lady caressing her belly with another person. It could be gender neutral, actually, which I really loved, caressing behind them. And it just said, you know, Jeannie and Ryan, which is my partner's name, 2021. So we were really, really overjoyed. And Christmas was wonderful. And I felt nothing until January 1st. I was New Year's Day. I was standing in a shower. And I got this overwhelming feeling like I was going to be sick to my stomach. And I threw up all in the shower. And from that day on, I think I threw up every single morning until maybe about 14 weeks gestation. I had a lot of morning sickness, but it was like clockwork because I was working from home and I didn't want to tell anyone that I was pregnant. I just wanted to kind of keep it private in my own private life. And I'd wake up in the morning and I tried every like remedy known out there. And I would just throw up, you know, in the morning and then kind of go on with my day. Slept a lot, slept on my lunch break, slept on breaks in the afternoon, and slept a lot in the evening. But it was a pretty standard, what you would imagine, pregnancy. Like my scans were all normal, baby was growing good, heart rate was good. And I felt, I know, Jen, I don't know if you ever felt this in your pregnancy or anybody that listens to your show, but as a plus size woman, I have a belly, like a B belly, as I think you call it. And for the first time in my life, I had extreme love for my belly. I wanted to see that bump as soon as possible.
Yes.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. And things were just trucking along beautifully. And at 16 weeks, I had another ultrasound just because I didn't have an OB yet. And the fertility doctor kind of released me at that point. They do it for your an abdominal ultrasound. And my cervix was measuring at 4 centimeters. It was nice and long and closed. Okay. The physician gave me that report. So everything was good. That was 16 weeks.
Yeah. And for anyone listening that doesn't know, you stay with your fertility specialist through the first trimester, and then you normally transfer and get an OB to then take over your pregnancy care, maternity care.
Exactly. And I actually was fortunate. I saw my OB at 20 weeks. So they were just weren't sure that I was going to get in that early because I guess there's a shortage in my region, but I was lucky enough that I did. So I had my anatomy scan. That's like the big ultrasound, I guess, where they kind of lengthy and they take all the pictures. And my little one at the moment, we didn't know if it was a boy or girl, but baby did not want to show something. So I had to go back for a couple missed views appointments, and we did everything, you know, drink sugary drinks and drink ice water and try to get the baby to move. And everything was just going well. I saw the OB, had a great conversation, told her about all my concerns. She's a younger, newer physician. And I said, look, I'm a plus size woman. I feel informed, but do I have any, you know, are you worried about any of the risks because of my body size? And she gave me the standard, like you're at a slightly higher risk for A, B, C, and D. However, that doesn't mean you're going to get it. And I'm not going to treat you like you are. If you're worried about something, come in and talk to me. I told her, you know, I was worried about gestational diabetes because my job, I'm a diabetes educator. That's my world that I live in as a nurse.
Yeah.
So I was just worried for my own self, not necessarily because I was a plus size person, but just because that's the world I live in. And
of course. Yeah. I've heard that nurses are kind of rough patients because you know it all.
Oh, we're awful.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, in that field, I could imagine.
I would not want to have to be my doctor, let's just say that. But She did not treat me. I left that appointment and I called my husband when I got in the car and I just said, oh, she's so nice. She was so nice.
I love that.
She didn't treat me any different. And I thought
You were provided with evidence-based care, right? Like, I don't think we should be afraid of conversations where we do talk about some increased risk because we should be informed, but we should never be made to feel as if any of those risks are guaranteed because there's no one thing that only plus-size people incur during pregnancy. We just have some slightly increased risk. So I don't think we should be afraid of those conversations. It's all about how those conversations take place. And what you shared was exactly what we'd want to hear from a care provider. And that's how you felt supported and you felt that compassion leaving that office. And that's what I'd hope for everyone.
I felt lucky, but at the same time I felt, okay, finally, like I feel like I'm getting the healthcare that I deserve. And the conversation wasn't because I was plus size. The conversation was because I was pregnant. And yes. It just felt so right and so good. And that was just earlier, just after 20 weeks plus one day. And I went for an ultrasound, a misfuse ultrasound, just the following week at 21 weeks. And the baby actually gave us a thumbs up. it's the cutest ultrasound ever. I can share it with you if you want. It's just so cute.
Yes. I would love to put it in the show notes if you'd like to share the picture of Mary.
Absolutely. Yes. The ultrasound tech was... just beside himself. He's like, oh my gosh, look at this. I can't wait to show you. And that was an abdominal ultrasound as well. And I felt really, really good. Again, nothing was off. And we found out that we were having a girl. So my husband and I had that very long, difficult, do we find out? And he really, my husband can't keep a secret to save his life. So we found out and I'm so glad we did because we decided we were going to name our baby Marion. That's after my mom. So my mother... I always wanted to name my baby girl after my mom. And so we started calling her by her proper name, Marion. So she was in my belly and everything was good.
Are you plus size and pregnant or trying to conceive? Do you wonder where you can find cute plus size maternity clothes or when you'll start showing and how to embrace your pregnant body? What about having a healthy pregnancy and how to reduce your increased risk? Find the answers to these questions and so much more within the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide and audiobook. From nutrition and physical activity to prenatal care expectations and the importance of hiring a size-friendly care provider, you'll not only learn information to help you make informed decisions throughout your pregnancy, but start to develop a new relationship with your body. Download this guide and start using it at any point in your pregnancy. Stop Googling and start feeling empowered today. Use code PLUSMOMMY to get 20% off the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide and audiobook.
I had really popped my belly, so to speak. I looked quite pregnant at that 20-week kind of appointment. And I was just happy, like the pinnacle of my life, right? Everything was going the way I wanted it to. I wouldn't have changed a thing. Yeah. You know, didn't have the picture perfect life that people might expect, but it was picture perfect for me. It was everything I always wanted. And I noticed on the Easter long weekend that I had a tiny bit of increased discharge. And I had just, because I was so nervous about getting gestational diabetes, I had just swam in a new pool. I did some length in a new pool. And I thought, I wonder if I've picked up a little infection or something from the pool or from the chlorine. Like, I don't know. This discharge looks a little abnormal to me. It was a little yellow, but it didn't have any funny smell. And it wasn't a ton, but it was enough for me to notice. And I said to a couple of friends that had just recently been pregnant, I'm like, oh, no, it's super normal. Your estrogen's really high. Your second trimester, blah, blah, blah. Well, that wasn't good enough for me because I saw it again another day. And it was a little bit more that day. And I called the OB's office the next morning and I just said, hey, look, like I got this extra discharge. And they said, unless there's blood, it's super normal. And I explained kind of the consistency and the color. And they're like, no, it's super, super normal. If you're worried, of course, you can go and be checked, but we would not recommend that. Okay, fine. So there's this little voice inside my head that was like, this is not normal. And then, of course, you hop on the Googler, right? Because that's what we all do. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm losing my mucus plug. That's definitely what's happening. But again, stop Googling, Jeannie. Just listen to your care providers. For once in your life, listen to care providers. And that yeah, that was Monday morning. So then Tuesday was a bit of a, you know, a tough day anxiety wise. And I'm not a person that usually presents with an anxiety kind of personality, but I was full of it and just beside myself and did not feel right. And we had another ultrasound that day and we saw Marion, and my mom actually came with me because my husband was working, and it was just a misfuse, and the ultrasound tech wasn't supposed to let anybody in, but he did. He did me a favor and let my mom in, and we got to see her, and she was wiggling around and doing acrobatics, and it was great. Then the next morning was a Wednesday, April 20th.
Let me just ask. So I'm sure at that point it was obviously you've only been having external ultrasounds this far into pregnancy, but they didn't even think to measure your cervix or anything because in their mind there was no concern about the discharge when you went in for that appointment?
Yeah, exactly. They had measured my cervix at 16 weeks. It was long and closed. And they measured it at 20 weeks in one day and it was long and closed.
So just like the week prior.
Yeah, just the week prior. Okay. Nothing had happened. And, you know, the ultrasound tech is he's been doing it forever and just the nicest fella. And I asked him, like, is everything the same? And I know he couldn't tell me, but he kind of said, like, if there's anything abnormal, don't worry, you'll get a phone call even before you leave the building. And I didn't get a phone call. So I was very reassured that everything was okay. But I woke up in the morning on Wednesday and I had I was onboarding a new person for work and doing an interview and offboarding someone. That was a really busy day. And I don't think I've called in sick to work in the last, I don't know, 3-4 years, not even a single day. I just, it's just not my style, not my personality. But I saw a speck of blood when I went to the washroom, like you would see when you crack open an egg, you know, sometimes just like that little teeny tiny speck.
Yeah.
If you have like a blood spot on an egg. And I went into full out panic. Like I could feel my blood pressure was through the roof and my heart rate was racing. And I thought, okay, calm down. It's probably nothing. Yeah. But something inside of me said it was something. So I called sick to work, which I think threw my boss for a big loop because I haven't done that forever. And I went to the restroom again and I saw a little streak of blood, like a little ribbon, like kind of dark red blood. And I thought, okay, it's still really, 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 like there's almost nothing there. It's like scant amount of blood, so little. But I called the OB the second they open at 9 o'clock. And the receptionist said, you know what, unless it's frank blood, I wouldn't be too worried. But Jeannie, you sound really upset and I think you should go to the hospital. She says, not because of your physical symptoms, but you sound like you're really upset. And I said, I am. And I called my husband and he was at work. He says, I'll come home. I said, no, I'm going to sit in my chair, my lazy chair with my cat and have a nap because I am having a full on meltdown.
Yeah.
And I just need a second to relax and I am safe and I am okay at this very moment. So I had a little nap, kind of could not calm down, but I did end up falling asleep for a bit. And I woke up and I decided, you know what, get over yourself. Stop being a crazy first time mom, go to Costco and buy yourself something nice. So I told my husband, okay, I feel a lot better, which was kind of a little bit of an untruth. I was just trying to distract myself because at this point, I think my anxiety was really the problem. And I got about 30 steps into Costco and I went to the bathroom and I saw more blood. And I just thought, oh my gosh, go to the hospital. And I drove myself to the hospital. It's about 40 minutes away.
I'm so proud of you for going.
Yeah. And I, you know, you're supposed to, because I was past 20 weeks at my hospital, they let me go straight up to the OB floor, but I was supposed to register and triage and do all this stuff. I didn't do any of that. I went straight to the nurses and said, I need to be seen like now, something's wrong.
Yeah, you knew. Yeah.
There's all these women in labor and they put me in this room where everybody's getting their non-stress tests done. And they put a blood pressure cuff on me that was like 3 times too small and it kept popping off and the machine kept going off, which means all the alarms kept going off. Which means nobody could hear their stress test being done in the room next to me, in the curtain next to me. So they assigned a student nurse to me to kind of keep turning off my machine. And my blood pressure, Jen, was like 170 over 100, which is like very, very, very high. And my heart rate was like, I don't know, 130, 140. Like I was, and they asked me, do you have any blood pressure problems? I said, absolutely, like not usually. I'm a very normal, tensive person at home. But something's wrong. And they said, well, maybe your blood pressure. It's not my blood pressure. And the student nurse looked at me and she said, I will talk to the doctor. And I thought, oh my gosh, good for you. Because when I was a student nurse, I was scared of doctors. But
right.
She promised me she would talk to the doctor. And about, I would say 20 minutes later, the doctor came and he's like, oh, your blood pressure is high. I'm like, doc, it's not my blood pressure.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, put your feet together. We're going to do a quick exam. And he did. And then literally it was like, all hell broke loose. It was like a scene out of the medical drama. He whipped back the curtain. They threw an IV in my arm. They put my head in, they put my bed in Trendelenburg position, which means my head was down at the bottom, like down, and my feet was up. So like massive head rush. And I was like, what did you see? What's going on? And nobody would talk to me. And I kind of reached up and grabbed for something, which actually one of the nurses, I grabbed her by her scrubs and I pulled her in and I was like, can you please tell me what's going on? And she looked me in the eyes and said, yes, you are 4 centimeters dilated and your amniotic sac is bulging through your vagina.
Oh my gosh.
And this is an extreme emergency. We are going to see if the tertiary hospital that was about a 50-minute drive away on the highway will accept you because this is an emergency.
Yeah.
And I hadn't even told my husband I was at the hospital at this point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was, and you know, like, yeah, it was crazy. And, long story short, I could hear that. I mean, you're in a small room. There's all these women, there's all these other women in there with healthy pregnancies, heartbeats galore, and people just coming in for checkups. And I could hear the doctor on the phone, the critical call, and just saying, you know, we have this woman and she's, you know, it's not good. And like, I mean, the medical jargon I could understand. And I knew in that moment, like, this is not going to be good. And I called my husband and said, you need to get here immediately. I might have my baby today. So he came to the hospital and COVID, he actually managed to pick my mom up on the way. I don't know how that happened, but they wouldn't even let her in. They just let him in. And by the time they let him in, they were actually loading me on a gurney to take me up to the next hospital. The doctor that was treating me at the local hospital wasn't sure if they would even accept me because I may have been quote unquote far to save, which I think he may have bent the truth a little bit in order to get me admitted to the other hospital. I'm not exactly sure how that happened, but, anyways, I took my first ambulance ride and I said, I get really, really, really car sick. Please give me something. And they gave me a couple doses of some anti-emetics, like, so I didn't throw up. And they didn't want any pressure on my abdomen. They wanted me in that position with my head down. And I did not know what was going to happen. And I really had no information. They sent a really, really senior nurse in the ambulance with me. And I remember so vividly looking at her. And I mean, I'm a nurse. I'm a well-informed human generally. And I said to her, her name was Elizabeth. And I said, Elizabeth, is this like a 911 emergency or a call your mom emergency? And she said, like, my friend, you're in an ambulance.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I thought, oh my gosh, this is real. This is happening. This is not a TV show. This is not a bad dream. This is my life. And I'll never forget her. I told her, I said, she said, what can I do for you? What do you need? And I just said, just distract me. And she told me about these chickens that she had at her farm. And they laid different color of eggs. And like, I think it was honestly the only time during this whole part of my birth experience that I was relaxed. My blood pressure reading was normal. And she said, oh, look at that. Your blood pressure is normal. I said, I told you guys, I'm not normally like this. Like, but anyways, I got to the large hospital and my husband actually met me, great timing, right when I was being admitted. I had to pee so bad, but I wasn't allowed to get up and I wasn't allowed to get out of that upside down position. So if you've ever tried to use a bedpan when you're hanging upside down in bed, you just pee all up your back. It's not very fun.
No.
But, we got kind of settled and the neonatal doctor was the first one to come in. He was the head of neonatology for the whole hospital and really well known in Canada. And he just looked at me, Jen. And when he just looked at me, I knew. Yeah. I was 21 weeks and 6 days and he sat down and he held my hand and he said, we will not do anything until you reach 22 weeks, which is at midnight. But just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. And we spent a long time, my husband and I, asking all the questions about what resuscitation might look like if I did deliver and what chances of survival would look like. And literally the day before, I was in an ultrasound, you know, having a thumbs up from my baby girl. And now I'm talking about resuscitation. And all these crazy things. Then the MFM, the maternal fetal medicine specialist, came in, and she's the person. So the neonatal doctor takes care of the baby, and the MFM takes care of the person who's delivering. And she did a manual check, and then she did an ultrasound, and she said, yeah, you're dilated 4 centimeters, and your cervix is effaced, which means there's like pretty much none left. And we typically could try to do something called a cerclage, which is like a stitch where they stitch your cervix closed, but you're too far gone. We can't do that.
Once you're dilated, they can't do it. Yeah.
And the amniotic sac was pushing through. Yeah. And I had an anterior placenta with Mary. So I had really not felt her kick very much, but I was starting to get a few cramps. And I said to them, I don't know, maybe I'm getting cramps or maybe she's kicking. I don't know. And they said, well, you might actually be in labor. And I thought, I'm in labor. I had no idea, but the cramps went. I have such a headache from being like with my head down. They gave me some Tylenol. They gave me a liter of fluid through an IV. I actually asked for it because I was so dehydrated. I hadn't eaten or drank in like quite some time. And they sent me just to like the unit and basically said, if you deliver tonight, which we think you'll deliver in the next couple of hours, your water will break and you'll just deliver. We won't do anything for you. And we won't do anything for your baby. And I was terrified. So all I did was lay still and I actually fell asleep.
Yeah.
And at midnight, I hit 22 weeks. And at midnight, they transferred me back to labor and delivery. Oh, the nurse who was working the ward just didn't. She's like, you do not want to deliver here because even if you did decide, if you hemorrhage or if you need something, we have to run you across the hospital. She's like, I don't want you to deliver here.
No, you need to be in labor and delivery. Yeah.
Yeah. So we got whisked back to labor and delivery, which I went from like a nice little hospital room to like this sterile operating room environment with a kind of a bed in it with all these machines for resuscitation for your baby and this and that. And my husband and I maybe got a couple hours of sleep through the night. He was able to stay with me. And
I'm so glad for that.
The nurses were just so lovely. Yeah. The nurses were so wonderful for me. Like, I was having, regular crying attacks, just being so nervous and scared. And the one nurse came in and said, do you want a popsicle? And I thought, yes, I do.
Yes.
And I also would like my mom. And she said, oh, she can come. Okay, my mom can come. So immediately, I think it was like 6 a.m., we called my mom. We're like, you need to wait for rush hour traffic to get over. And then you need to come. Just because my mom's 70 and I didn't want her driving this crazy traffic. And yeah. Pretty far away from home. And so she gave me a popsicle. She told me my mom could come, kind of kissed my forehead and tucked me in, And I was like, okay, I can do this. I'm going to be okay.
Yes.
And in the morning, a new doctor came to see me and my husband. So they said, okay, the neonatal doctor said you're 22 weeks and we can technically resuscitate. Although here's the reasons why maybe we shouldn't. Here's what you should think about.
Yeah.
And I had not had steroid injections and they said that they give steroid injections to help mature the lungs of the baby when the baby's premature, but I'd have to hold the baby in essentially until 23 weeks and 5 days, which was for me, that was 12 days I would need to lay in that position, which I totally would have, but they were very worried about my maternal risk. The maternal fetal medicine physician came in and talked to me and said, like, right now the baby is at a position where we could deliver. You do not have an infection right now. You do not have any presenting problems right now. However, here's all the things that could go wrong if we wait, or if we don't do anything. He said, you have two options. You can induce labor just like someone who's at the end of their pregnancy and is, needs to be induced. Or you can go back to the ward where you were and just wait, just stay in this position, complete bed rest and wait. Mm-hmm. In his professional opinion, he said, I thought you would have already delivered based on the way that you're presenting because you're fully dilated now.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow.
My water still hadn't broken. I wasn't having any cramps. I wasn't having any pain. But he's like, we didn't actually think you would make the night without delivering.
Yeah.
So in his professional opinion, it was a matter of hours. And my husband and I and my mom, we had a really difficult decision. what we wanted to do, but we decided resuscitation was not an option for us for the baby. If she was born before, like today, we were going to just go day by day. So if she was born at 22 weeks on April 21st, we would not resuscitate, but we would decide again. The physician held my hand and cried with me and just said, you know what, we'll come back every single day. And if you change your mind, we will change what we're going to do.
I am so glad they held so much space for you and treated you with so much care, because we look at, you know, viability being, you know, about 24 weeks. And so, Oh my gosh. I'm so sorry.
It was, the physicians were phenomenal, and the maternal fetal medicine doctor was very clear and blunt and straight to the point. And, the nurse, who's like a 30-year veteran, her name was Annalie. She was standing beside my bed, and every time the doctor would say something, I'd look at her, and she would essentially translate what he was said in his medical jargon into English, basic English for me. And I he gave me these options: induce, or do nothing. And she looked at me and said, "This is 100% your decision, but you have to honor yourself." And your husband and your body, and think about your future pregnancies and think about your future, everything. And in that moment, my husband and my mom and I, we decided that we would ultimately induce and go into labor. And I knew I would have my baby, and I knew she wouldn't live, but we were okay with that, because that was our option. So we did, we started the medication, and they said, you know, it's going to take 5 or 6 hours, but we're going to, you know, at least probably 5 or 6 hours, we're going to break all the COVID rules and let your family come. As many people as you can fit in this room, you could have come, because it's palliative. Wow. They can meet your baby. I called my brother, my older brother, and my sister, and my in-laws. My dad, unfortunately, is in a long-term care home, so he couldn't come, but, my in-laws, because again, they're older and it's so far away, they weren't going to come because they were worried about figuring out how to get there. Like, they don't know how to use their GPS, like that kind of stuff. Yeah. So my sister left work that was halfway to the hospital, came back to my hometown, picked up my in-laws, brought them up. My brother dropped everything from his job. My sister-in-law dropped everything. Everybody just came to the hospital. And you know what? I'm so thankful they did, Jen, because they told me, I took the medication to start an induction around noon. And the nurse said, you know, you're not on bed rest anymore because there's no reason for it. And I said, well, I'd really like to know where I am. I don't even know where I am. Can I, my husband put me in a wheelchair. Can we go for a little stroll? And she said, oh, absolutely. Go get some lunch. Go have something to eat. Try and find some type of joy. Like just go and clear your brain, get out of this room, get out of these clothes, so to speak. And I was probably 30, 40 feet down the hall when I had like the worst period cramp I'd ever felt in my life. I was like, oh my gosh. And they kept telling me, like, they could ask me, labor is going to feel like you have to poop. And I thought, what? I don't think so. Holy moly, Jen. I got this feeling like I had to poop. It was terrible. Yeah. It was so intense. And the cramps started coming and coming and coming. My husband just whipped the wheelchair around and took me back to the ward. And I said to the nurse, like, something's happening. And it had only been like an hour since they gave me that medication. And she said, like, it hasn't even worked, but let me check you. So she checked me and she's like, you know, on that next contraction, just give me a little push. And it was just her, my husband, my mom in the room. And I thought, okay. And I did. And I felt the amniotic sac come down. I could feel it. Like it was so strong. And she's like, give me one more push on the next contraction. The contractions were so strong and so close together. And it was just so instant. And I gave a big push and I broke my water. And she's like, keep pushing on the next contraction. And I pushed and pushed again. And baby girl was born at 1:10 with two big old pushes. And she was just a teeny tiny peanut at 14 ounces.
Yeah.
And she was born and perfect and breathing and perfect little eyebrows and fingernails. And my husband, who said he would never, ever, ever consider cutting the cord, jumped right in there and cut the cord. And within 20 seconds of her being born, she was laying on my chest. Yeah, it was beautiful. And she was, you know, at that young, they're not really breathing, right? Like they're not really breathing well, their lungs aren't functioning, but she was trying, she's gasping. And she's really dark in color. The nurse had prepared me that she would look dark because she didn't have any fat yet. So she was like a darker red color. So we were seeing kind of the blood that was the meat, but she looked like me.
And she was on your chest and she was born in such a beautiful space. And I'm glad it wasn't surrounded by so many medical personnel and that you were safe and secure and you were loved. And she's loved in that moment. Yeah.
It was just the nurse and my husband and my mom. And I, you know, like, you know, like in like those Star Trek movies where like they like jump to light speed or whatever. And like the world just stands still.
Yeah.
That, like, I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't see anything other than her. Smell just her. Like, the moment just stood still. And I held her for a good, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. And then my husband took off his shirt and he held her.
Yes.
And then my mom took off her shirt.
Yeah.
And she held her. And my in-laws arrived just maybe 20 minutes after that. So we didn't wrap, like, they held her. They kept their shirts on. They held her. There's enough nakedness going on in there. And the nurse really gave us our space and left us alone. And just, she gave me, I think, some oxytocin to help with, you know, placenta delivery and everything, which was smooth and normal.
Good.
And my baby girl passed away at 2:25.
Yeah.
I knew that was going to happen, but we still held her for a long time afterwards. And my brother and my sister and my sister-in-law, like, they all arrived and they all got to hold her. And the nurse came in with, because I didn't have any clothes, or I mean, I didn't think I was going to give birth, right? So they have people donate these beautiful blankets, and she wrapped her in a beautiful rainbow blanket, which was so significant because the day that I found out I was pregnant was a really dark day in December, and there was a huge rainbow, which is so odd, but I thought that was kind of my sign. And a beautiful little gown, and we held on to her. And one of the things I'll never forget is looking at my husband and saying, like, when do we know to give the baby to the nurse? Because when I gave Marion over to the nurse, I knew I'd never see her again.
Yeah.
And the nurse told me I could stay in that bed for as long as I wanted.
Good. Yeah.
But around 5 o'clock in the evening, the nurse said, you know, you really want, you know, do you want to have a shower? Like, your mom can hold Marion or your husband can hold Marion. And I agreed that I needed a shower. I thought it would make me feel, you know, maybe a little bit better. And my mom had a beautiful 20 minutes with Marion while I had a shower, and my husband kind of got himself together. And, you know, we just, at that point, when I got out of the shower, I held her and kissed her, and we just said, it's time. And we gave it to the nurse, and I just said, like, take care of my baby.
Oh.
And that's the last time I saw her. Yeah. But she, you know, I knew she was going to be well taken care of, and the nurse promised to put her in a pretty pink gown. And I knew, I never thought about what I would do if my baby died, but I knew my great-grandmother had passed away when my mom's mom passed away when she was really, really young, and she's cremated. And I said, I really want Marion to go with her great-grandma. And I wanted her to be cremated. Like, I was very decisive in that moment of what I wanted to happen. And anyways, that's how my baby was brought into the world. And we went into the throes of postpartum, and my milk came in, and I was planning a funeral, or rather a celebration of life, of life. It was a very, very, very non-traditional. In fact, we had everyone in attendance sing baby beluga, because there was a big significance to that. And my husband plays in a whole bunch of community bands. So we had a 15-piece band that our friend, the band director, put together, and they did Over the Rainbow and beautiful songs, because I just, you know, we wanted it to be a celebration for our baby girl. And still to this day, like, there's things that I'll never forget. And my husband talks about it, and he says he's doing okay, but there's things that he says that will just, like, make me melt. Like, he said, when I called him when I was at the hospital, I said, we might have our baby. He said the first thing he thought of is, I should stop at the pharmacy and get some diapers.
Oh, wow.
He thought we would bring her home.
Oh, God.
And, it's quite an experience to have to make those decisions. And then the aftermath of, you know, being a postpartum mom.
Postpartum. And, yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? They didn't, they asked me, do you want to stay over and go home? I said, I want to go home. And they basically said, okay. And the nurse was wonderful. She made me this memory box. She took little footprints and handprints, and she made me this sand sack. It's like in the shape of a heart, but it's actually the same weight that Marion weighed. And they gave me a cap, and they gave me a little bracelet, everything that a normal mom would have, and a few extra things to remember my baby. And I just remember like going down the elevator at the hospital and going to the car, and I'm in a wheelchair and the door's open, and I have this box, this memory box on my lap. And there's a brand new mom who just delivered her baby who walks out of the elevator beside me. And at that moment, I thought, I know my life will never be the same. But women need to know about cervical incompetency, because I didn't even know it could happen. I didn't even know that I could go into labor and lose my baby that quickly. I mean, I knew I could get diabetes, and I knew I could have preeclampsia, and I knew I could have a baby that had a genetic disorder or something. And we were prepared for all of those things, but I did not know that cervical incompetency or cervical insufficiency, whatever you want to call it, even existed. And all the physicians I've seen during my treatment and thereafter have said, you know, you are a classic presentation. No symptoms, yeah. No pain. In hindsight, the discharge I saw probably was a symptom. And you know what? This is a lesson to me and anybody listening. Like, if you like, listen to your gut. We know when something's off, and we will honor Marion forever and love her. And I have her nursery. It was you know, half done, and we're gonna finish it. You know, and we have her. She's cremated, and she's interned with my grandma at the cemetery, and we visit her on the regular. We've even painted her stone. Instead of making a headstone, I thought headstones aren't for babies. I want to make something. My mom painted a beautiful stone for our baby. But cervical incompetency is something nobody talks about, you know, and having that happen after the IVF journey, it's been a real, real, real up and down journey. The joy that I felt in the moment that I gave birth is something I've never felt before. And the holding space for joy and sadness of intense, immense qualities at the exact same moment is something I've never experienced in my life.
Yeah. I felt it as you shared your story. I'm not usually one to not have words, but I've been sobbing continuously for your story because it's so heart-wrenching, but it's so beautiful. Like, Marion was born into so much love and such a beautiful birth.
Yeah, it's incredible. And like, I'm her mom, and there's nothing, I didn't have, you know, I didn't get to pick out her first outfit, and I didn't get to make all the decisions that a mom got to make, but the decisions I did get to make, like, I wrote out her entire celebration of life. We had a family friend that recommended a non-denominational pastor who does, she like leads these celebrations, and she does LGBTQ marriages, and she'll do anything that anybody wants, whether they're religious or not. Mm-hmm. And I handed Trish this 7 or 8 page script and I said, here you go, this is what I'd like you to read. And she's like, this is the first time I've ever been given an entire script for a funeral or celebration of life. But you know what, that's the only thing I could control, and the only thing I got to do was her mom. Funeral homes make prayer cards. I made my own prayer cards, and I asked the lady at the local print shop to just expedite them. And I wrote my own poem on her prayer card. And like, we took our own pictures. We took so many pictures, Jen.
Good. Oh, I'm so glad.
Cause it's all we have, right? It's all I have. But I want everybody to know, like, having a baby that, you know, a baby loss, whether it's a miscarriage or a stillbirth or an early loss or a late loss or what we had, which is technically classified a neonatal death, one is not worse than the other. All loss is hard, and grief is terrible, and getting help is so important. I am seeing a social worker regularly. I have support groups regularly, and I tell everybody, like, people will say, do you have any kids? And it's really hard because it's a personal decision. Do you tell them? And so far I've told everyone.
Yes.
Yes, I have a baby, but she's no longer here. Yeah. So there's nothing to be like, I know there's a lot of people that hold this in secrecy and shame, and we shared our story pretty publicly on our Facebook page, just with our friends and family. And the amount of women that have come forward and said, I've had a loss, a late loss or an early loss, or I've never shared this, but it's just been incredible. The amount of people that have gone through it, and people go through it alone. So I hope nobody has to go through it alone. And that's our baby girl. I hope our experience can just bring light to this, just other people, kind of what the future looks like. And our future is long, and the road is going to be curvy, because now we have to figure out how we want to prevent this from happening. And we have, you know, more options to, you know, try again. And so to speak, I'd like to give Miriam a sibling.
Yes.
One thing I would love your listeners to really, I'd love people to understand and know that if you have an incompetent cervix, it's not your fault. And it doesn't matter. Yes. It's not your body size. It's not something you did or didn't do. And when I had that physician look me in the eyes and say, you did not cause this. And I asked him, I said, is it because I'm overweight? And he said, absolutely not. And I, you know, even in that moment, there's this trust that I lost the trust in my body that I had just built, but it had nothing to really do with my weight. It had everything to do with kind of just what had happened.
You've shared your story, and I am, again, just beyond touched, and I will try to compose myself. But as a childbirth educator, I really want to share a little bit more, because we've, you know, nearly all of us listening to your story have cried along with you. And, you know, we want to know what to look out for. So when this happens, so it's called incompetent cervix, but it's also called cervical insufficiency. When, you know, your cervical tissue starts to open too soon, as you shared, and you can give birth prematurely. When they mentioned the cerclage early on, that's when they suture the cervix closed, and they can do it as long as you haven't already dilated. So that can happen around the 14-week mark. And it's usually done for people who have a history of what Jeannie has shared with us in her story. But there's that part, right, that I can only imagine all that you were going through and being like, wait, there's something. And then to know that they couldn't. There are also some medicines, and if you were to get pregnant again, they would very likely monitor and measure your cervix about every 2 weeks with ultrasounds to keep a lookout. But I think it's most important, as you shared in your story, to trust your gut. And you did nothing wrong ever at any point, at any time. But for those curious about symptoms, there can be a sensation of pelvic pressure, a new backache, mild abdominal cramps, a change in vaginal discharge, and light vaginal bleeding. But I would also like to point out that those are all common symptoms of pregnancy, right? And that's what you were hearing from all of your friends. And then, like, Google tells you the worst. Friends and family are reassuring. Your care providers were, like, reassuring too, because most of the time it's normal. But it was your gut that you were listening to, and your gut brought you to the doctor's office. So that is one of the biggest takeaways from your story that I will never forget, and I hope no one ever forgets, is that you know your body and your baby best. I want to be clear, there's nothing you can do to prevent it. There's no prevention except for the things that we shared that can help. But what can help overall is just doing all you can to have a healthy pregnancy, which is exactly what you were doing throughout your pregnancy. So it's just heart-wrenching.
I will share one thing that the maternal fetal medicine doctor did say, because I asked him point blank, yes, you know, like, my cervix was long and closed, like, less than 2 weeks ago. Like, what gives? Like, what happened? Like, how did this happen so fast? And the one thing he did say is that abdominal ultrasounds, which are traditional at that gestation, the bladder can distort the image. So he said, you know, although it says on the report your cervix was this long and this, you know, looked like this, It may have not actually looked like that, because they weren't looking for it.
Right.
And the bladder maybe, you know, did distort the visual, you know, all those kinds of things. So he was very, very, very quick to the point in reassuring that although it's not my fault, you know, and I didn't do anything and I didn't lift anything. It's not because I had, you know, sex with my husband a week prior, like nothing I did to cause this. But, you know, at the same time, it's not always a super definitive diagnosis on exactly why, when, and how, because, you know, until it happens, you don't know that you're looking for it.
Yes.
And in my case, you know, it was just too late. There are women in there's a Facebook group called Incompetent Cervix Awareness. I joined it almost immediately. I recommend it for anyone who's even interested or, you know, has been diagnosed with a shortening cervix, because some women, or some people with uteruses, they can catch that their cervix is shortening and they can get that cerclage even in an emergent situation. And sometimes they can go to carry, you know, really term babies. And yes. Some people have a situation that was as fast and as hard as mine. So there's so much information out there about it, but also there's a lot of misinformation. And I'll share just really quick, Jen, like I saw my family practitioner last week for a different reason. And he does not practice OBGYN medicine. He's a family practitioner. And then he's new to me. I've only met him a handful of times, but he just said to me, you know, I think your obesity is causing these miscarriages. And my husband was present with me, and I looked him in the eye and I just said, are you an OB? And he said, no. And I said, well, I've seen many OBs and they have made it very clear to me that that is not the case. And please don't body shame me, because I'm not here to talk to you about that. And I have not had miscarriages. Like he just made such a blanket statement that was so inappropriate. And I thought, boy, you need training, buddy. Like first person language, sensitivity, grief, and all that kind of thing. And my husband said to me later, he's like, I didn't know whether I should stand up for you and, you know, kind of tell the doctor to like get lost, or whether I should sit back and say, you know, good for you for standing up for yourself. But I was, you know, my blood pressure was probably already high when I was there, but I could feel it going up. Like, how dare you this on my body? And he backtracked and apologized immediately, but the damage had already been done. And I think I'm grateful that I've lived in a space where advocacy for me, I've been working on it.
Proud of you. But I'm so proud of you.
I realize there's a lot of people out there who they either can't, or they're just not able to. And they might feel a lot of shame because of some very insensitive, uninformed comment. And I really, really, really hope that nobody has to go through that. My physician apologized. He's since apologized and said, you know, he did not mean to do that. He did not mean to say that or make me feel that way. But in the moment, the damage was done. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so many of us have had those damaging experiences. And that's why, again, all the positive stories that you shared too in the beginning, and your support with your fertility journey, like such a reminder that there are excellent care providers out there, and we shouldn't stop if we want help in any way, shape, or form, whether it's fertility or you have a lump in, you know, your breast and you're concerned about it. Like, do not allow negative experiences with care providers to paralyze you from going after and seeking the help or support that you need. That is so incredibly important. And to never like dismiss any concerns in your gut that something is wrong, because I don't care how many years of medical school or how many certificates care providers can put on their wall, they will never know your body better than you do.
I totally agree, Jen. Totally agree.
I'm just so honored that you shared your story and marrying with us, and that I know your story is going to make an impact in other people's lives, and that Marion will too. And I celebrate her. I honor you. And I just wish for you and Ryan all the very best, and will forever be thankful that you wanted to come on the show and share your story.
And thank you so much. And for any of your listeners or that have gone through this or know someone who is, you know, the only thing I can ask is please be kind, you know, and just give them that graciousness. And losing a baby is, whether it's early, late, mid trimester, doesn't matter. Going through a loss like this is life-changing. And I've been so fortunate to have kind people around me and people like yourself and this platform that are, you know, welcoming and honoring. And that's the beauty in all of this. That's the joy. And the ability to share is something that's really near and dear to my heart, because I wish I would have known. Not that it would have changed anything, but I may not have been feeling so shocked when everything happened. So thank you for putting this platform out and having plus size women or plus size people like myself or partners or whomever being able to access really good quality information and empathetic information that helps us have the healthiest, happiest pregnancies that we can.
It's a privilege to do this work and to hold space for people like you. So yeah, I just can't thank you enough. And yeah. Oh, well, I hope we will all, you know, Jeannie and myself included, do some good self-care after this time that we spent together and honor ourselves and our emotions and our stories too. So, yes, thank you so much. And thank you, friends. Until next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.